to Sunni scholars. He says the following: فَغَضِبَتْ فَاطِمَةُ بِنْتَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ وَسَلَّمَ. Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet, she became angry with the first caliph. فَهَجَرَتْ أَبَا بَكْرِ, she turned away from the first caliph. فَلَمْ تَزَلْ مُهَاجَرَتُهُ حَتَّى تُوُفِّيَتْ. This, turning away and sadness continued until she passed away. So this is Sahih Bukhari. Some Sunni scholars believe that all the narrations in Sahih Bukhari are authentic.
Yes.
So he's saying that until her demise, she was angry with the first caliph. This is in Sahih Bukhari, volume 3, page 1126. Again, Sahih Bukhari, volume 4, page 1549, says the following: فَوَجَدَتْ فَاطِمَةُ عَلَى أَبِي بَكْ فِي ذَلِكَ. Fatima Zahra became angry with the first caliph. فَلَمْ تُكَلِّمْهُ حَتَّى تُوُفْيَتْ. She didn't talk to him at all. The narration of Sha'abi says that no, later the first caliph comes to her and talks to him.
Yes.
And talks to her. But this narration says that no, فَلَمْ تُكَلِّمْهُ. And for sure, this narration in Sahih Bukhari is much important than that narration in the book of Bayhaqi.
It's more authentic.
Exactly. حَتَّى تُوُفْيَتْ, until her demise. Yet in another part of Sahih Bukhari, we read the following: فَهَجَرَتْهُ فَاطِمَةَ فَلَمْ تُكَلِّمْهُ حَتَّى مَاتَتْ. The same point has been mentioned. This is in volume 6, page 2474. And let me just share with you another narration which is mentioned by Ibn Qutayba. He says the following. He says that the first two caliphs, they came to visit Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha. Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha did not permit them to enter the house.
So they asked, but there was no permission.
Yeah. But then they resorted to Imam Ali alayhi salam that, please ask your wife to permit us to enter the house. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam then went to Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha and explained the situation that they have asked me. And the answer of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha is very interesting and heartbreaking. She says that al-baytu baytuk, this is your house. If you deem it proper, you may give them the permission. Now it's been mentioned that Imam Ali alayhi salam, to give them the last chance so that later they may not bring any excuse, he gave them the permission, because later they could have claimed that we wanted to ask her to forgive us.
Yes.
But Imam Ali alayhi salam did not permit us
and
to enter.
And you didn't let us.
Yeah. So according to this narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam permitted them. They entered. They asked for forgiveness. But Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha said that, I'm not going to forgive you. And then she said the following, that نشدتكم الله ألم تسمع رسول الله يقول. I adjure you by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, didn't you hear that the Holy Prophet was quoted as saying, رضا فاطمة من رضاي, the happiness of Fatima is my happiness and her anger is my anger. Whoever loves Fatima, it is as if they have loved me, and those who make her happy, they have made me happy, and those who have made her angry, they have made me angry. Both of them, they said that, yes, we heard the Holy Prophet say that. Then Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha said the following: if this is the case, فَإِنِّي أُشْهِدُ اللَّهَ وَمَلَائِكَتَهُ, I take Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his angels as witnesses that أَنَّكُمَا أَسْخَطْتُمَانِ وَمَا أَرْضَيْتُمَانِ, you two made me angry and I did not forgive you. So this is the very explicit answer of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha. Not only that, وَلَئِنْ لَقِيتُ النَّبِيلَ لَأَشْكُوَنَّكُمَا إِلَيْهِ, even if, later when I meet my father in the hereafter, I will complain against you to him.
Yes.
Not only that, وَاللَّهِ لَأَدْعُوَنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَيْكَ فِي كُلِّ صَلَاتٍ أُصَلِّيهَا or عَلَيْكُمَا. I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I will pray against you.
Yes.
After every prayer that I say. So this is the true answer of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha. as mentioned, for example, in Al-Imamah wa Siyasa, volume 1, page 17. So with these narrations, how we can claim that Fatimah al-Zahra Salamun alayha forgave the...
And after all, if she was satisfied with them, why she would ask to be buried at night?
This is a very good point. And I have brought some narrations which tell us explicitly that one of the main reasons that Fatima al-Zahra Salamun alayha asked to be buried at night was that I do not like those to take part in my funeral ceremony. So if she had forgiven them, it was no reason for her to insist upon that. But her insistence tells us that that narration is just...
She was sad and heartbroken.
Exactly, and did not forgive them till the end of her life.
Thank you. Yes, so this way it's been clear for us that there was a meeting and it had been permitted for them to visit her, but that does not mean that she forgave them. And that is the rest of the story. Thank you, Dr. Karimi.
My pleasure. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he is an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. as Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners. Hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Inside the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iranian judicial experts gathered to reveal the details of a probe into the U.S. assassination of Iranian top military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
The U.S. justifies this crime by branding it as self-defense or targeted killing. There is no such legal term in the international law. It is an assassination and cannot be justified by fake terms. It's an extrajudicial murder which violates the U.N. resolutions 1368 and 1370. Furthermore, based on the Chicago Convention, the use of UAVs in another sovereign country requires a permission of that country. Iraq says it did not give such a permission to the U.S. to carry out the strike.
Iran and Iraq have formed a joint investigation committee comprised of Iraqi and Iranian judicial experts. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, more than 120 people have been identified in connection with General Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
General Soleimani was on a mission to Iraq, a mission that concerns the fight against terrorism. The Convention on Special Missions protects the rights of General Soleimani, but Washington breached that convention as well. So all these violations of international law are considered a crime, and we are taking the case to international judicial bodies to penalize the perpetrators.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from the terror group. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists, something which experts say leads to a safe interpretation that Washington must be on the terrorists' team.
2 years have passed since General Soleimani was assassinated, and Iran is still as resolute to prosecute those behind the incident. Iran's judiciary calls the culprits the terrorists' comrades, saying it will not stop until all perpetrators are brought to justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In a press conference in the capital Sana'a, Yemen's Eye for Humanity Center for Rights and Development released its new report on the Saudi crimes committed against Yemenis during 2021. The report highlights the number of victims of the Saudi air attacks and the destruction of the country's infrastructure.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has escalated its raids against civilian facilities and residential areas crowded with civilians in Yemen and tried to justify this by saying that there were military activities in those areas, which was not true. We monitor all the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and the victims who fall in Saudi airstrikes and mortar shelling.
The report says Saudi warplanes have launched over 9,900 airstrikes against civilian facilities across Yemen last year, killing 387 civilians, including 96 children, and injuring hundreds more. In a previous report, the human rights group said more than 43,000 civilians had been hurt or killed in relentless airstrikes across Yemen since Saudi Arabia launched a war on its southern neighbor in 2015. It said nearly 4,000 children were among those killed.
As people around the world celebrate the New Year with festivals and joyful events, Yemenis enter a new year of war and siege imposed on their country by Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the years-long resistance will eventually bring Riyadh to justice for its crimes in Yemen. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
From France has assumed the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union for the next 6 months, with Emmanuel Macron promising to make the world's largest common market into a more influential and independent bloc. Yet the European Union begins 2022 beset by major difficulties. The open wound of Brexit, marginalization in global geopolitics, an uncertain post-corona economic future coming on the heels of a lost decade of economic growth, and deep divisions on the issues of immigration, right-wing economics, and relations with Moscow. The European Union appears to be at a crossroads. With Angela Merkel finally stepping down, there is no clear leader or figurehead. Emmanuel Macron wants to assume her mantle, but many say that his liberal strongman approach to the Yellow Vests has reinforced perceptions that the EU is not just non-democratic, but anti-democratic. Historically, no country's elite has been more pro-Europe than in France, and no French leader has been more pro-EU than Macron. However, analysts remind that Macron only has the power to push the EU's agenda in a certain direction and not to decide policy unilaterally, as he has often done in France.
It's a bit egotistical and ethnocentric to think that France will be able to accomplish anything more than Slovenia, Sweden, or any of the other previous heads of the European Union. So, in the matter of a common defense policy, of a green energy transition, of economic regulation, of ending economic stagnation, Macron won't be able to accomplish in 6 months anything which Brussels hasn't been able to achieve in the past 10 years.
With a tightly contested presidential election looming in April, it seems certain that Macron's continental-sized ambitions will be constrained by domestic politics.
C'est plus un obstacle.
I think Macron will find the rotating presidency to actually be an obstacle to his re-election ambitions. Representing the interests of 70 million Frenchmen and also 450 million citizens of the European Union, and also being a candidate running for re-election, are three very different hats to wear. He will find himself in many conflicting positions.
The philosophy of Angela Merkel was marked by avoiding tough solutions to social questions while also demanding right-wing economic changes. As the EU emerges into a very different post-corona world, Europe may be demanding different solutions and possibly even different leaders before France's rotating presidency is over. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
'21 has come to an end, but the battle for peace and justice still continues here. In the Indian-administered Kashmir, people are hopeless more than ever as things have slipped from bad to worse. The Indian government said Kashmir will return to normalcy when it abrogated its special status in August 2019. But after that, the region has seen an outburst of violence. Media reports say that over the last 3 years, nearly 900 people have been killed in the region. Out of these casualties, 580 were militants, 180 were government forces, and 125 were civilians. People here say they are not hopeful that the central government will bring them justice and treat them fairly.
People are often excited on New Year's Eve, but we are an exception. We are fearful of what might happen to us the next year, because this year was full of bloodshed. We only seek peace through dialogue.
We had terrifying experiences in 2021. So many lives were lost. The region's unemployment rate is highest in India. Some decisions were taken against the people of Kashmir, which were not expected. Now we seek nothing but peace. 3 decades of strife is enough.
Following India's move to cancel the region's partial autonomy, Kashmir has witnessed many changes coming without the consent of its people. For example, people who are not permanent residents of Kashmir were barred from purchasing property up until 2 years ago. But now, all Indians can buy property in the region. People here say the room for dissent is limited. Those who criticize policies of the government are frequently detained, so people of Kashmir are forced to be silent. In 2021, the region saw around 275 incidents of bloodshed, including civilians, militants, and government forces. Estimates say 189 pro-independence fighters have been killed in 2021, but authorities say challenges are still there.
hybrid militancy is the biggest challenge for the year 2022. A major achievement in 2021 was the peaceful burial of Saeed Ali Gilani. 168 militants are currently active in Kashmir.
The Indian-administered Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries claim the region in full but rule it in parts. More than three decades of low-intensity conflict in Kashmir has exhausted the region socially as well as economically. Almost every household in the region has suffered losses. New Year is no time for them to celebrate. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
This gathering in Iran's town of Shahrareh is a tribute to a man who's known as the father of national security in Iran, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Ahead of the second anniversary of his assassination, Iranian people and senior officials gathered to commemorate him and mourn his loss.
General Soleimani is no longer with us, but his legacy will continue across the generations to come. His assassination is a huge miscalculation on the part of the US. He was an influential axis in the region, and his assassination led to the humiliating ouster of American troops from Iraq and then Afghanistan.
General Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was killed in 2020 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism in our region. So by assassinating him, the U.S. sought to dispose of him to allow the terrorists to roam freely in the region to serve the interests of the American government.
By assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. thought in vain that it will stop his anti-terror activities. But in fact, Soleimani is still alive in the hearts of millions of Iranians who will continue his path stronger than ever.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that resulted in the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. His efforts made him known as the nemesis of the terrorists in the region. In 2020, millions of people in Iraq and Iran took part in his funeral ceremony to pay tribute to him and bid him farewell.
2 years into the incident, Iranians still mourn the loss of General Soleimani. They say they will not forget his endeavors in the fight against terrorism, something which earned him the title of a national hero and the guarantor of regional security. Yusuf Jalali from the town of Ray.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani, says there's been relatively good progress over the past few days in the negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
The main focus of the negotiations was sanctions removal. We had several meetings with the EU coordinator and the three European signatories, both on verification and guarantees.
Iran says it will go back to its nuclear commitments only after it verifies the full removal of U.S. sanctions. Tehran has also demanded guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the JCPOA again or impose sanctions that violate the deal. A European source close to the negotiations says all participants agree that verification and assurances have to be reflected in the final document, but that there are still questions on how that is possible. So are these issues going to create major obstacles in the way of a final agreement?
Yes, it's a major problem because these European diplomats know quite well how verification can take place. It's not something strange. If the Iranians cannot use the banking system because behind the scenes the Americans are threatening banks, then that's a violation of the JCPOA.
Russia's lead delegate Mikhail Olyanov said he believed an agreement could be achieved in the first half of February, adding that although the discussions were difficult, there was steady progress.
General impression, business-like atmosphere, positive trends, recognized by everybody, all by all participants. We need to be patient, persistent in our efforts, and we will overcome all the problems.
Informal consultations are set to continue within the framework of the Vienna talks. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
Years on since the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, made headlines, and Iranians still grieve his loss. On the second anniversary of the incident, thousands gathered at Tehran's Grand Mausoleum to pay tribute to him. Addressing the gathering, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi vowed to bring those behind the incident to justice.
If Trump and Pompeo are not tried in a fair court for the criminal act of assassinating Lieutenant Soleimani, Muslims will take our martyrs' revenge.
General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport, on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Soleimani is well known for dismantling Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from Daesh. This made him rise to fame in the region as the mastermind of the fight against terrorism.
Lieutenant Soleimani did not allow the terrorists to approach our borders. We owe our security and stability to his sacrifices.
If it wasn't for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the entire region would have collapsed and fallen under Daesh control. Not only Iranians, but the people of the region are indebted to him.
The U.S. thought in vain that by assassinating Qasem Soleimani, it would stop his fight against terrorism. But in fact, the incident gave rise to a united front in the region against Washington, and that's what led to the humiliating ouster of American troops from the region.
Iran says it is seriously following up on its legal pursuit to prosecute those behind Soleimani's assassination. Iran and Iraq have recently formed a joint investigation committee comprising judicial experts from both countries. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, more than 120 people have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
People say by assassinating General Soleimani, the United States tried to disrupt the regional fight against terrorism, something which they say put Washington on a confrontational course with the countries in West Asia and marked the beginning of its exit from the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
France has broken the European record for corona infections, and nations across Western Europe are also reaching new daily highs as the pandemic has entered a new but seemingly less deadly phase.
The coronavirus right now is exploding right now in France. It's very scary to see. I saw over 200,000 infections in France in one day. So I'm nervous. I'm trying to get back to the United States right now, and I'm waiting for a COVID test right now. I'm very nervous. I want to make sure that it's negative so I'm able to get back home.
France currently has over 4 million active cases of corona, but 99.9% of them are classified as mild. Daily deaths are half of what they were a year ago, while shorter quarantines are being approved. Cases are soaring in part because many more people are getting tested prior to holiday gatherings, but France's hospital admissions are just a third of previous peaks. It appears increasingly certain that the new Omicron variant may spread like wildfire, but that it is significantly less lethal, causing many to have a cautious sense of relief.
Corona is mainly just a bad flu. It's only a serious risk for certain types of people. But for the overwhelming majority of people, if you get vaccinated, if you quarantine when you have symptoms, if you use common sense to protect yourself and others, then all will be fine.
The high transmission rate of Omicron does have some taking scientifically questionable steps not seen since the early days of the pandemic. Paris has just made face masks mandatory in all public places, even outdoors. Some nations which aren't seeing an increase in cases have banned public holiday festivities anyway. France, Italy, and other countries are debating making their health passes even more restrictive, which many say is an abuse of personal freedom. France has long been considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world, but measures which amount to either get vaccinated or live in social isolation have coerced 80% of the country into getting vaccinated. One fact appears vital. In France, the unvaccinated are far more likely to be in intensive care than those who have chosen to be inoculated. What many are hoping for in 2022 is that Omicron truly does herald the end of the lethal phase of Corona 19, which would render moot the controversies and uncertainties over how to best handle the long-running pandemic. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Guardian has learned a British police officer took selfies at a murder scene where a teenager had been stabbed to death and sent appalling racist, homophobic and offensive images via WhatsApp. We now present you an article written by Vikram Dodd. The piece is titled UK Police Officer Took Selfies at Murder Scene and Sent Racist WhatsApp Images. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The Guardian has learned a British police officer took selfies at a murder scene where a teenager had been stabbed to death and sent appalling racist, homophobic and offensive images via WhatsApp. A tribunal has decided that PC Ryan Connolly from Merseyside Force committed a litany of disciplinary offences over a six-year period while a serving police officer. While on duty, he also took photos on his mobile phone of people in mental health crisis in hospitals who had been sectioned under police powers. His case echoes that of two Metropolitan Police officers who used their mobile phones to take pictures at the scene where two sisters lay murdered. The pair were convicted in court and sacked in a case that rocked policing. Details of PC Ryan Connolly's wrongdoing have been confirmed by Merseyside Police after inquiries by The Guardian. The Merseyside Force said Connolly's actions had undermined public confidence in policing and were an insult to the majority of police officers who served the public with distinction. The Discipline Tribunal found that Ryan Connolly guilty of gross misconduct. He had resigned before the November hearing, and after the tribunal he was formally sacked by Merseyside Police. Merseyside Police said their anti-corruption unit had caught Ryan Connolly and his offensive behaviour. Connolly had also had an association with a known criminal without informing his bosses. PC Ryan Connolly joined the force in January of 2003 and had served under the police identification number 2133. According to papers lodged with the tribunal, his offending against police rules began back in 2014. PC Ryan Connolly was accused of a litany of offences mainly involving his personal Samsung mobile phones. The disciplinary panel found that PC Connolly took photographs or had images on his phone he should not have had, and that he frequently shared them. Its findings include: PC Ryan Connolly had photographs and graphics that were grossly racist and one depicting Muslim people. He also had an image of a Ku Klux Klan member. The Ku Klux Klan, commonly shortened to the KKK, or the Klan, is an American white supremacist terrorist organization whose primary targets are African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, as well as immigrants and Muslims. In 2016, and again in 2017, while on duty, he took photographs on his mobile phone of men detained by police under mental health powers, who were in hospital, and shared it via WhatsApp. While on duty, he took and sent a photo of men in hospital on at least two occasions. He took photographs of people who had been arrested. In October of 2015, he took a photograph while on duty of someone who had slashed their wrists and shared it via WhatsApp. He took a photo of a fellow officer's rear and shared it via WhatsApp. In 2016, he sent a graphic homophobic message. He took photographs in 2018 of himself at a murder scene where he had been assigned to guard the cordon after a teenager had been stabbed to death. He took photographs of crime victims, including someone missing from home, and shared details about a woman who went to police for help alleging that she had suffered domestic violence. Other images mock disabled people. PC Ryan Connolly was cleared of trying to acquire cannabis while a serving police officer. When interviewed by detectives from Professional Standards, Ryan Connolly made no comment. Before the disciplinary hearing, he provided a written statement saying he did not know why offensive images were on his mobile phone. Merseyside Police's Deputy Chief Constable Ian Critchley said, "Connolly had taken photographs of vulnerable people on his personal phone whilst on duty as a police officer. He breached a duty of confidence, lacked honesty and integrity, and throughout his discreditable conduct, he has underestimated public confidence." Between 2015 and 2018, Connolly stored images on his personal phone that were racist, homophobic, and severely offensive, and on some occasions had shared those images. Connolly maintained contact with a known criminal and did not disclose that relationship. As a result, by socializing and associating with a criminal, he brought the whole police service into disrepute. Ian Critchley added, "An investigation by our anti-corruption unit uncovered the fact that Connolly had been using his own phone to take photographs of vulnerable people whilst on duty, and that the phone also contained an appalling homophobic, racist and offensive images." He added, "The behavior of this police officer is deplorable and serves to undermine the public confidence and trust in the police." He claimed, "Our police officers carry out exceptionally brave and selfless acts every single day, protecting the most vulnerable people in our communities. Yet here we see the despicable acts of a very selfish individual who has no place in our police service." UK police said the pictures from the murder scene only showed PC Ryan Connolly and did not show the teenage murder victim. Merseyside police claim they will enhance their vetting procedures following the case. Connolly, in a written statement to the tribunal, said he could not recall the offensive images after they were shown to him during interview by detectives, or how they came to be on his mobile phone. He added, "I do have the insight to know that the images should not have been in my possession. This has been a learning experience for me to be more mindful of WhatsApp groups that I'm in and being more aware of the material that is sent to me." Connolly's mobile phones were seized in February of 2020 by detectives from Merseyside's anti-corruption unit. He resigned before the disciplinary tribunal in November, which ruled he would have been sacked if still a serving police officer. He is barred for life from rejoining the police service.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم سلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, you're listening to IRIB English Radio and this is Youth Station. I'm your host Hassanain Inayatullah from India, a seminary student from Qom.
Assalamu alaikum, I am Jafar Saeed from Houston, Texas.
We all welcome you to the show, and today we're going to be discussing about elites. Actually, a few months ago, the Islamic Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the elites as the light of nations' eyes. So what do you think about elites? Like, what are their specifications? Who do you call an elite?
Typically, when you hear the word elite, yeah, you think of the people who are, you know, well off, the top percent of, suppose, a country,
yeah,
or a nation, right? Where most of, say, the economy runs
well
through
off
them.
In what sense? In terms of knowledge, in terms of money, in terms of wealth?
Typically, the Supreme Leader was also referring to those elite in terms of knowledge.
Okay.
And not just like overall knowledge, but in specific fields.
But don't you think that elite means someone good at a particular task, you know, someone best at a particular task, at the field of study or the study of business? Do you think like that?
That's,
you know,
exactly
someone,
what,
someone best at...
That's what I'm saying, right? So it's not just knowledge in a whole.
Okay.
It's more specific towards a field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So say medical, but not just medical completely. Say, suppose, a neurosurgeon.
Okay.
Or, say, internal medicine,
yeah,
right? A very specific part of that business.
Yeah.
Right? Not just the business in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it from a Western point of view, an elite is someone who's, you know, living life, who's got all the money in the world, he's got a big place to live in, he's got multiple cars. But obviously, the Supreme Leader was talking to the people in a sense of knowledge and understanding one another. Not just, you know, the physical world and just having money and property.
Yeah, if we refer to the speech of the Supreme Leader, and then he says that, you know, first of all, he says that the elites are the nation's eyes. He also mentions that, you know, they have the various solutions for various types of problems. And he also said that by thanking all the people who he was addressing, he said that, you know, everyone should take their own responsibility. You know, even the talented and the people who are supposed to be their teachers. And elite should not just be in, it's not just about educational purposes, but you should also have gratitude with that. You should be, you know, gratitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Uh-huh.
You should
okay,
be thankful.
You should be
that,
thankful,
right?
For being, say, someone who has a expertise in a specific field. You understand that these elites, you can split them up in two different groups here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those who really put in the time,
okay,
right? They're really working on their craft,
yeah,
and they become experts in it. where they don't need to go and check with someone else. People come to them to make sure, suppose, what they're doing is the right way of doing it. And then the other group are people who, they just have a God-given talent, right? It just resonated with them. They didn't really have to put in a lot of work. They understood it immediately. They grasped that concept, or I guess not just the concept, but how to carry out in, suppose, a specific field.
There's definitely a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But what sometimes we forget is, you know, we have that potential in ourselves, but we are depriving of turning that potential into actual.
I agree with that. And sometimes it's not even an outside force that's preventing us from doing it. We're our own barrier here. We're stopping ourselves from really actualizing that potentiality that's within us all.
Why do you think we stop ourselves? What are the factors that stop us?
Okay, what factors that really stop us? What other people think about us, right? What we think about ourselves. Like, some people, they judge themselves more than other people judge them, right? So they're harder on themselves than the world is actually hard on them. So they see themselves at a higher stage than what other people witness. So they put themselves under tremendous stress regarding the simplest things, right? That's one. You have the outside effect of people judging you for doing something, for saying something, for standing up for something. For most people, I guess this doesn't like specifically apply to the elite, but it's, you burn out in a specific field, right? Where you're like, no, I just don't want to do this anymore. I've been doing this, say, 10, 15 years. You know, I'm tired now.
Like losing the passion, you mean to say?
Exactly, right? You're burning yourself from both ends, right? Like, the drive that you had in the beginning, it's gone now. Whether that's that you're losing interest in that topic, or you're not getting the support that you were once getting. Say, when you first started a specific, I guess, course, or a specific ideology, there were people with you.
Yeah.
People are intrigued, they wanted to join you, but now you're slowly seeing those people leaving.
Yeah, let's just discuss that after a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Dear audience, welcome back to our show. And before the break, we're discussing about elites and their specifications. And we reached to a point that we see young students, they get into this field of studying or maybe any different field. But we see that after a span of time, they lose their interest in this field. And they're no more considered to be as an elite, or they don't reach that stage of being called an elite. So what I think the factors that comprises of, you know, all these consequences, I feel that, you know, when a person is entering into a certain field, before entering into that field, he should know his interests, he should know his passions, he should know about its consequences, what it can lead him to.
With all this in mind, who would accompany this definition of an elite?
What field are you talking about?
No, I'm talking about in general. It doesn't have to be a specific field. But under this description of an elite that you just said right now, someone who's passionate about something that they're doing, who has a drive behind it.
Okay, like if you're talking about the religious personalities, like it's a different aspect. And if you're talking about, you know, I mean, if you're talking from Ahlul Bayt, it's a different aspect.
Okay.
If you're talking from scholars, it's again a different point of view. If you're talking from, like, you know,
the common people. Okay, so then why don't you just give an example of each one, right? Say, if you're separating them to that extent where the scholars are on one side, the common people are on the other side, and then you have the Ahlul Bayt at a much higher level, then even with that, like, distinction, then I guess just give an example here for, I guess, the Ahlul Bayt in its entirety. Are elite.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So now,
you're right about that. The first person that comes in my mind when you talk about elite is Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Okay, so
the perfect man. It's a deep ocean. You find everything over there. You find knowledge, you find piety, you find strength, you find everything over there. When you talk about elite in science, like in the modern sciences, you see, I see Einstein as an elite.
Okay, so you told me one from, say, the scientific point of view.
Yeah.
But what about, again, we're going to go back to what you said earlier about the scholars.
Yeah.
What about someone who's, say, in the seminary?
Okay.
So the bigger scholars who go and help other people out, what about them? Do you have an elite in mind out of them?
Actually, a couple of scholars. But, you know, it's, again, difficult to mention any one scholar, right? The first one that comes in my mind is maybe Ayatollah Khoi.
Okay.
Because he was a great scholar, as you might know him. All the ijtihad we get from him, you know, deriving Islamic laws and everything. You know, he had a great seminary in Najaf, and all his students.
So in a way, he's changed the fabric of the seminary.
Exactly. You know, he has thousands of students who have passed from his madrasa or his college.
In your opinion, can someone who was brought up as a common man reach the stage of the elites?
Well, that's a good question. Sayyid Jafar, if you notice all the elites we're having now, before they were considered as to be an elite, they were all common people.
Okay.
So they reached, they passed the stage of being a common man to being an elite. Now, if you say that there might be people, they try very hard, like Allama Tabatabai, or Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai.
Okay.
As his name, the full
so
name.
So he was a common man and he became an elite?
He was a common man. He used to go to the seminary to study Islam. He had to study one dars, one lesson, seven times.
So he put in the work to become an elite.
He put the work, and the point we mentioned before, you know, when you put the work, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps you.
Okay. You have a point here. If someone puts in the work, they can reach that status of eliteness. What if someone's putting in the work, but it's just not sticking in their head?
Exactly. That's the same example I'm giving you, right? Allama Tabatabai, he had to study one verse for seven times. He put in the work. Now, when you put in the work, what happens is, when you put in the work, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he pushes you to your goal.
Okay.
That's what happens. Then, he became the great Allama Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai.
I'm saying, suppose you grab someone from, say, Canada or America, right?
Uh-huh.
Say someone who's an agnostic or an atheist. They don't believe in God, right? And you're like, look, I'm going to make you an elite, right? So this guy, he's not understanding basic, say, mathematical concepts, basic scientific theories, right? He doesn't have a belief in God. He doesn't have that, if I put in the work, God's going to, you know, do the other 50.
Yeah, I have a great example for you. I have a great answer for that question. Now, you find many elites in the Western countries. How many of you do think that they believe in God? You find many elites in the Western countries that they don't believe in God. How it works is, when you work really hard, Allah is the one who rewards you.
But realize this person doesn't have a belief in God, right? So he's just putting in the work. What you're saying is, you put in the work, and God's going to fill in the rest.
Yeah, you get what you work for.
But this person doesn't believe in God.
Yeah, you get what you work for.
Okay, so here, let me ask you one last question before we wrap up the show.
Okay.
When I asked you name an elite, you named Einstein.
Yeah.
Right? Obviously, the Western elites, they're well known across the world.
Yeah.
Right? But now, suppose I went and grabbed an American and asked them, you know, name, say, a Muslim elite. Mm-hmm. Someone who's changed the face of Islam to an extent.
Okay, like Ibn Sina, I mentioned,
they won't have an answer. Why is it that their elites are more well known, while the Muslim Islamic elites aren't known?
We are also a part of this fault that, you know, this thing did not spread well.
Okay.
You know, we did not propagate this thing.
What could have we done to help propagate this better?
There might be two things, I guess. You know, either we did not propagate it well, or the other thing is, the others didn't let this thing to be propagated.
Okay. So you're saying, on one hand, it's our fault. on the other hand, is that they limited us propagating it in general.
When you talk about mathematics, mm-hmm. you know, one of the main part of mathematics is algebra.
Okay.
The founder of algebra, or the father of algebra, is a Muslim, right?
Okay.
But how many of people know that?
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. How do we let them know, look, it was a Muslim elite, the master of math in general,
in fact,
who came up with algebra?
In fact, it's easier in these times because you can use your social media platforms. Indeed, you can find many videos nowadays on YouTube where it mentions, like, you know, the Muslim founders of different things. Okay. You know, the first founder of university in different countries.
Okay.
Now, it's easier so that you can use these platforms and let the world know.
Okay. But then and they could also use these platforms to propagate their own elites more.
But we can still do our part, right?
That's fine. But I'm saying over here, you're saying that we have...
And one more responsibility what we have is we should encourage our Muslim youth to get forward in this field. We should encourage our children to reach that stage so that they become an elite. And the fathers and the teachers, they should help their children and the students. Today we discuss about elites and their specifications. It's actually really good when we encourage our students. We let them know about the Islamic scholars and the Islamic founders. We should encourage our children so that they reach that stage, so they can be identified or considered as an elite in the future, inshallah. That's all the time we have for today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.